Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
So good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Preetha, and I'm really excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us. Every story is the beginning of a conversation, whether it's within ourselves or with others. Across time and culture, stories have been agents of personal transformation, in part because they have the power to change our hearts and minds. The purpose of our weekly calls is to share stories from incredible changemakers from around the globe. Through thoughtfully guided conversations with them, our special guest speakers share their personal stories and inspire us through their actions, their experiences, and their insights. Our hope is that these conversations will plant seeds for a more compassionate and service-oriented society while serving to foster our own inner transformation. Behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this beautiful space. We are thankful to them and to all of our listeners for helping co-create the space. Today, we're grateful to have a remarkable guest speaker with us, Anil Ananthaswamy, whose personal journey is not only inspiring, but has had a tremendous impact on many people. Thanks again for joining today's call. Let's start with just a minute of silence to anchor ourselves into this space. So welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call. Today we're in conversation with Anil Ananthaswamy. Here's how the call works. In just a few minutes, our fabulous moderator, Gayathri, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Anil. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into open reflections, Q&A, circle of sharing with all of our guests, where we invite all of your reflections and questions. I've already opened up the queue right now, so at any point you can hit star 6 on your phone and you'll be prompted when we get to the top of the hour and it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. And if you're following along through the web, you can also submit a question through the web. So this week's theme is Explorations in the Edge of Self, which is kind of a tantalizing theme. Our guest this week is an award-winning science writer who uses neuroscience to examine the nature of the self. We have the pleasure, the remarkable pleasure, actually, of having Gayathri as our moderator today. Gayathri is actually somebody who was a student of Anil's, and through a strange set of convergences, through the magic that is the service-based ecosystem, she was reconnected to him in preparation for this call. So it's really remarkable. Gayathri Ramachandran is a scientist by training and a gardener by hand and heart. Her PhD research examined how sticky protein clumps in the brain result in Alzheimer's disease, while her postdoctoral research asked how the diet and gut microbiome of worms affects their stress resilience. She's currently on a sabbatical from paid work, holding questions of life in the self while volunteering with service-based and tree planting initiatives in her native Chennai in India. So thank you so much, Gayathri. It's a pleasure to have you here. So
thank you.
I'm going to pass it over to you to introduce Anil and kick off our conversation with him.
Thank you. So I'm really excited to be here. Today's guest, Anil Ananthaswamy, is an award-winning science writer with numerous articles published in prestigious science magazines such as New Scientist, National Geographic News, Discover, and Matter. He's also the author of two books. The first, called The Edge of Physics, reads like a travelogue to some of the most remote places on the Earth where experiments are being done to understand the nature of the universe. The second, called The Man Who Wasn't There, explores what cutting-edge neuroscience and psychiatric research can tell us about that most primordial of human questions, who am I? Based on interviews with patients suffering from various neurological disorders, each of which result in the loss of some aspect of what most normal people think of as integral to their sense of self, Anil attempts to peel apart what the self is and how the brain constructs this coherent identity. Anil came to science journalism through a circuitous route and was a software engineer in Silicon Valley in his previous avatar. He divides his time between the Bay Area and Bangalore. He also teaches an annual course in science journalism at the National Center for Biological Sciences in Bangalore, where I did my PhD and was part of the first batch of guinea pigs that took that course. So it's a real pleasure and a privilege to do this interview with him. Welcome, Anil, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Gayatri. It's really my pleasure to be on this call. I've known about it for a while now, and so, yeah, it really is my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Wonderful. So I thought we'd start with talking a little bit about these two themes that you wrote books on, the universe and the self. I know that many of your articles and features as a science journalist have also been on the latest research on these topics. So I'm curious how you came to choose these themes to write on.
I think the things that I write about are really driven by curiosity. And I think in the beginning, when I started as a science journalist, maybe because of my training in engineering, electrical engineering, I was kind of predisposed to thinking more about stories about physics. And even within physics, I sort of gravitated to thinking about the big questions in cosmology that physicists are trying to answer. So I think, if you think about what that kind of physics, especially cosmology, is trying to do versus some things that are of interest to me in neuroscience, there really are questions about existence, whether it's the coming about of the material world in terms of the universe, matter, galaxies, stars, etc., and the eventual emergence of life, or once we as living beings think about who we are, then it's about our individual existence in relation to this larger thing. So I think somewhere, to me, these are all related inquiries, and I find them equally interesting.
Yeah, that's beautiful, especially the way you said that, it's connected to this whole question about what our existence is on a cosmological scale or the individual scale. So I'm curious, do you remember the first piece you wrote on either of those subjects? Because, I guess you might remember. Was it?
Actually, I wouldn't be able to. It's been about 15, 16 years of doing this now, so it's hard for me to recollect the exact first piece. In terms of the neuroscience, I think some of the early pieces were about explorations of the sense of self. There were some features that we did as new scientists that's where my interest in the subject began.
Mm. I was wondering if you remember the very first influential book, pop science book, that you read on either subject?
I definitely remember the one on physics. It's a book called The Universe and Dr. Einstein, or it's Dr. Einstein and the Universe. I forget what it's how it's phrased, but The Universe and Dr. Einstein was this thin paperback that I had actually bought as a student back in Seattle when I was doing my master's, and I left for India. I came back to Bangalore to work in Bangalore, and I had brought that book back with me. And I remember picking it up one night, and I couldn't put it down. It was, I think I read the book through the night, and it was a very, very, it was an exhilarating experience to just read about ideas as profound as the ones that came out of Einstein's mind.
So that definitely
was something that set me on the path to thinking about science and science journalism and science writing.
What about neuroscience? There are some quite well-known pop science books, Oliver Sacks, V.S. Ramachandran. Did you read any of them?
I have, and I think there were two books in particular, and those two names that you just said, Oliver Sacks and B.S. Ramachandran, their books would be the ones that I would have named as probably the books that influenced me, both in terms of the neuroscience, but also from the perspective of a writer sort of wanting to write a certain way. You know, both Sachs and Ramachandran, I think Sachs's book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat,
yeah,
that was a really, really powerful piece of writing. And Ramachandran's Phantoms in the Brain, both of them were, I think, very influential for me in terms of thinking about wanting to write and wanting to think about these subjects.
So that connects nicely to my sort of second question, which is really about your second book, where I think you write with great empathy about people who suffer from these disorders like COTAs and Alzheimer's and BIID, which is Body Integrity Identification Disorder. So I haven't read your book yet, but I did read your long-form piece in Matter on that BIID patient you accompanied to his amputation.
Right.
And it was like, it was really a beautiful piece of sensitive writing. So I'm curious about how this experience of listening to first-person accounts humanizes your understanding of these disorders.
Well, I think the first thing I would like to say about that is, meeting so many people who shared their stories, one of the things that went out of my vocabulary was thinking of these as disorders. So I think maybe you know, that will be something we can talk about is, you know, normally we use phrases like somebody is being normal and somebody is having a mental illness or somebody having a mental disorder. And one of the things that happened to me over the course of the writing of the book was just this really profound feeling that we shouldn't be thinking like that. We shouldn't be thinking, I mean, yes, people are suffering and that should not be discounted. And but all of these conditions, and that's about the only word I feel like I want to use is, being human is a condition, and within that we can have variations in how we experience life. And so someone who is suffering from schizophrenia is really, there is someone suffering from schizophrenia rather than saying someone is a schizophrenic. I think there is a subtle difference in the way language sort of, you know, is used when you say someone is autistic versus saying someone is suffering from autism. You're kind of beginning to acknowledge that there is always an experiencer of these various symptoms, and humanizing the person behind who might be suffering. And so one of the things that happened really for me was this transformation of kind of not wanting to think anymore in terms of disorders or abnormalities or normalities, etc. So it's all a spectrum. We're all on the spectrum somewhere. That was a big change that happened.
I'm also wondering whether, in addition to talking to some of these patients or persons, did you talk to any of their family members, like, you know, the most intimate relationships they might have and how those people, you know, viewed this person and their condition?
Yeah, oftentimes, because some of the conditions are such that the person can find it quite hard to express what it is to be suffering from. Let's say, take the case of Alzheimer's disease. By the time Alzheimer's really sets in and it's mid to late stage Alzheimer's, you can't really, if you're just talking to the person who's suffering from Alzheimer's, it's very hard to get a sense of what has changed, at least middle stage Alzheimer's. But if you talk to, say, the spouse or the son or the daughter, and they can tell you how things have changed. So you have to, I did talk in many cases with family members and friends to get a more complete understanding of what it must be like to be suffering from any of these conditions.
So I'm assuming then that means that, you know, with, for example, Alzheimer's, it would mean that there's more than one way to communicate your feelings. And so even if they have, you know, short-term memory loss, family members would sort of still be able to pick up on so many other cues. And, you know, this goes to this question of how, do you know what extent the narrative self, you know, is kind of distorted when you have Alzheimer's. And I'm wondering whether you got a sense of that.
Quite strongly, because in fact, so when I looked at these various conditions in the book, the intent was to see if the disruptions to the sense of self that are caused by these conditions, can they tell us something about the nature of our sort of unified sense of self? So if you think of these conditions as kind of cracks in the facade of the unified self, then you know, what do these disruptions tell us? And one of the things that Alzheimer's disrupts is the sense of being a narrative. So we all have a sense of being a story. So if you were to ask someone, who are you? You are, you know, very likely to get an answer that sounds like a story. And it's not just a story that we tell others. It's a story that is internally running within our heads. That's how we think of ourselves. So, and these stories are essentially, you know, episodic memories strung together in some sort of timeline that is coherent and because of short-term memory loss and eventually loss of cognition and, you know, all of memory, one of the things that Alzheimer's does is it really, in the beginning, disrupts the narrative self in the sense that it starts scrambling the narrative. So when you're trying to tell someone, say if you're talking to someone who has mid-stage Alzheimer's and you're asking them about their life, if you didn't know their life story, you wouldn't be able to tell whether they're telling you exactly what their life was like. But if you do know their story, then you'll find out that they're actually scrambling the narrative, that their timeline in their minds about what happened when is scrambled up. And eventually that whole narrative self is gone because Alzheimer's has literally taken away their memory. So there's no way to construct a narrative anymore. But there's also other serious things that happen with Alzheimer's, which then doesn't allow them to even communicate what it must be like to be someone without a narrative. So from the outside looking in, caregivers, people who are taking care of these people with Alzheimer's would use phrases like, "Oh, there is no one in there anymore," or so implying a loss of self. But it's not at all clear whether that's the case, because we don't really know that from a first-person account of what it is like. This is all this is all inferences from the outside, from caregivers.
And were all these different patients you met, were they always willing to talk about about their experience, or were they reticent?
These were already a set of people who had agreed to talk. Otherwise, the fact that they are in the book is because they did agree to talk. There were other people I contacted who didn't agree. So I have not written about the people I've written about are obviously the ones that did, to some extent, agree to talk. But even within the course of a conversation, it was not like that. The first time I talked, they could share everything. Sometimes it would take many conversations to get to that point where they felt comfortable about, because these are very personal and very serious things that they are sharing about themselves. Some were concerned about anonymity, some were not. And so I couldn't say that everyone was like this or like that. There were very different responses to my questions from people. But eventually, over time, the people I write about in the book, they were all those people who eventually opened up to a large degree.
And did any of them read your book? Like the ones who still have this capacity
Some of them did, some of them did. And a lot of them would have read pieces about them before publication, so they kind of knew what I was writing about them. And not everyone, but a lot of them had actually vetted I was writing about them. So it was not a surprise to them. But in terms of reading the whole book, they might have been aware of the fact that I'd written about their lives, but they hadn't read. They didn't know it was in the context of the whole book. So some of them did read, and they liked it. So I'm very happy about that, because to me, that was the first order of business, that I wanted to make sure that my sources who had shared you know, such very, very intimate details about their lives that they in no way felt, you know, that I had not betrayed their trust somehow. So that was important to me, and so all the people who read it were fine. They were happy with it.
That's beautiful to hear. So I'm curious, but do you have one story that comes to your mind that really moved you amongst the many you covered, or you totally can't pick one?
There are some sad stories for me within the context of the book, especially to do with Alzheimer's. The two patients that I write about were elderly. One was in mid to late stage Alzheimer's. Both were men, and the second man was in very late stage Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And Alan, whom I write about, he died before the book was published, and the other man, he died after. But, and you know, I know their family members, at least a couple of people. So that, I think for me, writing about Alzheimer's, seeing what it does to a person was hard. And then having both my sources pass away in the course of, you know, the publication of the book, that was hard. But really, almost everyone shared some very deeply felt things about their lives, and so I can't really pick. You know, I can think about each of the people I talk to, and you know, if I sit with thoughts about them, they all had some effect on me. I wouldn't be able to pick or choose, saying this one moved me more than the other. It depends on which aspect of their lives I'm thinking about. I think everyone had some impact on me.
So that I'm a little curious about that. Could you actually tell us a little bit about what changed for you personally? So I know you mentioned this fact that you are very careful about your choice of words, and not just it's not just a thing that you're careful about, it's something you really strongly believe internally, that these are just conditions and we're all on the spectrum somewhere with different abilities. But I'm also curious about whether some other things changed for you personally before and after writing this book, The Man Who Wasn't There.
Yes and no, in the sense that the broader kind of inquiry in the book is about the nature of the self. You know, so we constantly hear about this idea that the self is an illusion, and that there is nothing permanent about the self, that there is a certain kind of impermanence to what we are, etc. All these things, they were just ideas for me, things that I had read about in other books, and actually trying to inquire into it deeply in order to, because when you're trying to write something, when you're trying to explain an idea through the lens, in this case through the lens of neuroscience and neuropsychology and neuropsychiatry, anytime you're trying to explain something to someone through writing, you really need to understand the subject in a much more visceral way than if you were just reading it for yourself in a book and trying to understand it. So that the deepening of the understanding of what one truly means by impermanence, what one truly means by the idea that the self is an illusion, all these things, they took root, I think, to an extent that wouldn't have been possible if I hadn't actually met. So the people that I met, like someone suffering from schizophrenia or someone suffering from Alzheimer's, they were not necessarily thinking about the self. So this whole question about what these conditions tell us about the self was a kind of a meta-analysis that I was trying to do after looking to their stories, right? So even though I would ask them about notions of the self, etc., to the extent that I could, the synthesis part was happening after listening to their stories and coming back and sitting with whatever they had told me, and not just them, but the philosophers that I was talking to, or the neuroscientists that I was talking to. So putting all that together definitely deepened my own understanding of what theologies or philosophies mean when they say that the self is impermanent, or there is no such thing as the self, or the self is an illusion. And so and in the beginning I said yes and no, and that's because how much this kind of knowledge affects one really also depends on your own state of mind. So there are times when I think I'm affected by it, and then there are other times when I'm just, you know, not affected. I mean, I'm basically it's a kind of knowledge that slips away, and you go back to being that solid, permanent self that is constantly trying to protect itself and is insecure and is worried. And so just the knowledge of it doesn't change things, but it has helped. It definitely has deepened the understanding of what those things mean.
So to clarify, so do you think the self is an illusion, or do you think it's the same as consciousness?
The reason I am kind of hesitating is because when I wrote the book, I actually did not take a stand on the nature of consciousness. Right? I actually the book manages to show that much of what we think is permanent, for instance, the story that we are, right? The narrative, or even things like the sense of being a body, the sense we have that, oh, my legs are mine, my hands are mine, and which we don't even question these things. These are all things that are being constructed by the brain and body moment by moment by moment. I mean, it's a continuous process. So the self, the sense of self is actually just it's a process that both the body and the brain are involved in. What one can't answer with empirical neuroscience or with philosophy at this point or with theology is the notion, is how does the I emerge? Like, no matter what one is experiencing, there is always an experiencer. Mm-hmm. So there's always a subject of experiences. And finally, the question of what is the self comes down to answering where does that subject of experiences come from? How does that arise? And so it's true that much of what we take to be permanent is constructed and is, in that context, an illusion, in the sense that the permanence is an illusion. The experiencer, the subject of experiences, that becomes a much more difficult question to answer. I think that within philosophy, within neuroscience, you will find scientists and philosophers who will say that even the sense of an I is just an appearance. It appears because of the way other elements of our material body interact. And that's also a certain kind of Buddhist point of view. That it is the interaction of psycho-physical elements that give rise to the sense of an I. But there are also differing opinions within philosophy of mind and within neuroscience as to what that I might be. And it could be that it is the outcome of consciousness itself. Now, and the reason why I hesitated in the beginning is the moment one says that it could be consciousness itself, well, we can't yet define what consciousness is. There is a lot of debate about whether consciousness itself is an illusion. The fact that it feels like, that consciousness feels like it is something immaterial, that it is not of the body. Could that feeling itself be an illusion? Or is it something really a thing apart from the brain and body? We don't know. So do I think it is consciousness? It could be. Could it be just the material world? It could be, and we don't know. I mean, honestly, if you're actually looking for empirical evidence to support any viewpoint, there is none.
Right.
So I wouldn't be able to tell you. So it just becomes a question of belief at that point.
And but do you believe that science can actually answer this question, the hard question?
The hard problem of consciousness. So in the book, I definitely didn't take a stand on consciousness. I deliberately, right. I made it a point to say in the book that this book does not address the hard problem of consciousness. Since then, I've been thinking more and more about it and reading, people who, philosophers of mind and some neuroscientists, and I am certainly leaning more and more towards a materialist explanation. Now, you know, a lot of people, when they hear that word materialist explanation, feel as if we are denigrating something very profound. And but I don't think of it like that at all, because the other side of the things I write about, which we talked about earlier, cosmology and the beginning of the universe. I mean, the universe is so incredible. I mean, when you think about the material world, just the material world, there is nothing simple about it. There is nothing, you know, the body is a material thing. There is nothing simple about it. So
nothing trivial about being stardust.
Nothing trivial about being stardust. Nothing trivial about having a heart and a lung. I mean, absolutely nothing trivial. The brain is a material thing, and it is not trivial at all. We haven't a clue how it works. In terms of, you know, so just saying something is material should not be an act of denigration or reducing something that we otherwise consider profound. So I think the fact that the universe exists, the fact that the material universe exists, is a profound thing. So and can science explain that? It's just a hunch. I mean, there's no way to tell, but it's a hunch that it will, or it will be able to tell you why it can't. So I hope that it will come to that point where it will become extremely clear that science will never have an answer, or it will say, okay, this is what it is. But again, saying there's always this strange dichotomy within the way we think. We somehow relegate science to one side of how we do things. I mean, to me, science is just a process. It's a way of understanding our world. And even if I think about what Buddhists have done over millennia, that is an empirically based exploration of the mind. It just so happens that they experiment on their own individual minds. They go within and take their subjective experiences and somehow are making sense of it. Now that's still a process to me. That's as there's a debate right now within neuroscience about whether, you know, the subjective experiences can ever be amenable to the scientific process. Uh-huh. And there is a debate, and a valid debate. But then, to me, that's also part of what science is. And there are scientists and there are philosophers of the mind today who are arguing that we need that kind of science that, say, the Buddhists have done over two millennia in trying to understand the mind from within, in conjunction with the kind of science that we normally think of, which is, you know, third-person objective science that, say, three people looking at something from the outside can agree upon as to what it is. Yeah, I think science will be at least able to tell us whether we can answer it or not.
So, I mean, I asked you about science, but I'm wondering if you have any personal spiritual practices that have also influenced the way you think about the self.
Not from an I have attempted to learn meditation, do meditation. Haven't been very successful at maintaining a practice. I think my meditation is writing. When I write, I think that is a form of meditation for me. But not, you know, knowing what a meditation instructor would say about what meditation is, I don't think it's the same thing. But it's a meditative activity rather than meditation itself. Writing, that is, for me. But I don't think I have experientially come to any place where I can say that, you know, has influenced my outlook. saying that, the desire to learn meditation, the desire to read about cosmology, the desire to understand the neuroscience of the self, I think they're all linked in my mind, that they're all part of the same inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't feel separate in my mind that I would want to learn about the neuroscience of schizophrenia and at the same time want to meditate and see how the mind feels when I'm meditating. They all seem very related to me.
Hmm. I was also wondering whether you said you talked to a bunch of neuroscientists and also talked to philosophers. Did you talk to philosophers across traditions? Or was it, Western philosophers, I'm assuming, because they're often in academic departments, but...
I did talk to philosophers because philosophy of the mind, especially when it comes to nature's questions about the self and consciousness, you do end up intersecting with the kind of philosophy that has come out of some Buddhist thinking or Hindu thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I didn't explicitly talk to people who are, I would say, theologians who would be mm-hmm. representative of certain kinds of Eastern thinking, but I did talk to philosophers who are embedded in the academic environment who are thinking about Eastern philosophy and Western philosophy and seeing how they inform us about questions of the self. So people who understood Buddhist thinking or people who understood Advaitin thinking alongside Western philosophy, analytical Western philosophy, etc. Yeah. So I did get a fairly good sort of cross-section of people that I could talk to.
Mm. And are there any philosophers of either Eastern or Western training who are also active neuroscientists who, are doing some of the actual experiments? Or these are disparate?
There are philosophers who are very empirically grounded, if that's what you're asking. Even though they may not themselves be doing the neuroscience, because these are pretty big silos that they're part of. If you have to become a philosopher in any kind of tradition of philosophy, you essentially given up the first 20 years of your life. So you can't then go and say, I'm going to do lab neuroscience, bench neuroscience. So, but there's a lot of crosstalk. And so those were the people I was interested in, people who were actually taking neuroscientific empirical evidence into account in their philosophy. So whenever they were coming out with ideas about notions of the self or consciousness, if empirical evidence was kind of going against their way of thinking, they would be open to just dropping that idea. So there are people who are straddling those words, even if they're not actually doing neuroscience, but they are people who are very, very aware of what's happening.
So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit at this point about sort of what your early childhood was like and what were maybe the early influences in your life in the domain of science and also the domain of
I'm a terrible person to be asking these things because I have a very, very bad memory. It's really one of my losses. I really don't remember much about any kind of, with any kind of specificity, things about my childhood or, huge turning points or this or that. It's somehow, I have friends in school from primary school and kindergarten who will remember the color of the sort of canvas on the rickshaw that they were sitting. I don't remember ever sitting in a rickshaw with them. So it's one of those things where those details are lost to me. So I wouldn't be able to answer that question.
Did you ever, when you were a child, have any sense of, a strong faith in God, that sort of thing? Or were you never really?
No, nothing particular. I grew up and my mom is religious. So I grew up around religion, but she's always been hands off as far as making me do this or that. And I think I always remain curious. So I have read about religion without being religious in the traditional sense. But then I would read about all religions. It's because I was born into a certain religion. I haven't felt the need to only restrict myself to what my religion of birth says about the world. So it's been a fairly open-minded inquiry into what religions have said. I don't have any particular faith that I say that I strongly adhere to.
I know that you grew up in Bhilai, where and your father worked in SAIL.
The steel plant there, yes.
Yeah, so I was wondering how, just being part of that community and seeing such a major manufacturing industry, what influences that had on just, your scientific sort of self as a child. Because
I don't think the manufacturing plant itself had any particular effect that was... As a child growing up, even though the town is, by modern standards, quite small, but when you're a child, something that is 10 kilometers away was, just too far away. It's not something in your immediate sort of, horizon. You can see the chimney stacks of the steel plant, but that's about it. I think what it had, the real effect it had on all of us growing up in a town like that was the social effect of growing up in a community where all your parents were either doctors or engineers. Right? So all these people who had come to work in the steel plant were engineers, and then, and the others, most of them were doctors who were basically part of the medical system there. And so I think that certainly had an effect on all of us kids growing up there. Some, good and also detrimental, because it was also a kind of place where you couldn't think of writing as a profession at that time. But then that might have been true of India of that time everywhere, not just Bhilai. But Bhilai in particular was very focused on engineering and medicine. So, it took me 15 years after doing my engineering to start thinking about being a writer and sort of getting away from engineering. Not to say that what I studied didn't help me. I think it was profoundly influential in terms of how I think. But so the environment, I would say, had its pluses, but also had its minuses, because you couldn't think outside that box necessarily of engineering and medicine.
So no artists came out of your cohort?
Eventually people figured it out.
Eventually.
Right? But I think as a child growing up, when you're just trying to figure out what to do next, the options. But again, I think that was not just Bhilai, this was in the 80s, and I think most of India would have been like that. So the notions of becoming an artist would have been a very privileged notion, and I don't think most people would have entertained that at that time. It's different now.
So when you were a software engineer in Silicon Valley, and you just decided one day to go to the science journalism program in Santa Cruz, or it was a slow burn?
It was a slow burn. I think by the mid-90s, I had started developing a real desire to write. But at that time, I thought it would be writing fiction. So I remember giving up my job and sort of taking up consultancy so that I could work for 6 months and then just take 6 months off, and I would come back to India and I would... attempt writing fiction. So I did that for about 3-4 years. And it never occurred to me that I could combine science with my writing. Even though I was an avid reader of popular science books, somehow it didn't occur to me personally that I could be one of those writers. And I just happened to bump into a friend's friend who had just finished this one-year science writing program at UC Santa Cruz. And the moment I heard that, I knew that that's that is something I had to do, because it, just the idea of spending 1 year in a university just writing was that was bliss. So yeah, so once I found that out, then it was a quick decision. I just went and applied and got in, and then that's how it all started.
So personally, do you believe in destiny, or you're just agnostic?
My mind analyzes that question in multiple ways. I start thinking about notions of free will and what science is telling us about free will, mm-hmm. and that it's really not there. I think about the physics I write about, and really, there's almost no place in it for free will in the material world. So yeah, I believe in destiny? I do think our actions have consequences, but whether each of our actions is something we have control over, I am agnostic about that at this point. I don't know. I am agnostic about the notion of free will. Anything I do now. Sorry.
No, go on.
No, I'm basically that point that every action has a consequence, but what leads us to that action, is it completely determined, or is there some place there for free will, is unclear. I think we're dealing with extremely complex systems.
Absolutely.
So the thing is that whether you're talking of systems at the level of the neural networks in a brain, or the combined neural capacity of all of humanity, or the neural capacity of all of humanity interacting with the rest of the material world. I mean, these are incredibly complex systems. So, and in complex systems, there might be things that look like they are unpredictable, but that's pure chaos. It's not that they're not deterministic, it's just that we don't know enough to be able to determine what's happening.
Mm-hmm. We don't know the rules of chaos?
No, we know. It's just that it takes a very small perturbation in the system to set it off on a completely different trajectory, right? And no amount of we just do not have the wherewithal. If you just take a system like weather, we do not have the computational resources to predict what's going to happen. Even though in principle, if you knew the initial conditions exactly, and had the computational resources to compute the trajectory of the system, you could. But we don't, and so that's what chaos is, and a small initial perturbation can send off the system into a place that you would not have thought it would go to, and I think we are such systems. So
I was also wondering if you could tell us a little about your sort of writing practices. Maybe do you have a method now after so many years as a science journalist?
For a journalist who's earning a living, doing this for a living, there is a method, and that method is called a deadline. And so, deadlines are pretty much, especially if you're writing for magazines and newspapers, deadlines are what dictate. Learning how to write when there's a deadline is pretty much what you have to figure out how to do. Books are slightly different because the deadlines are longer, but the longer deadlines are just a kind of mirage, because there's also a lot more to do, and they eventually catch up. So I'm right now finishing up another book, and I'm already 15 days behind deadline. So deadlines are pretty much, and within that there are methods. If you're writing a short news story, there's you just have to write to deadline. It might be due in 2 hours, and you just have to do it. Longer stories, yes, you try to come up with a method, but I really haven't settled on any method. It's just I do it when I can, and if you're writing a lot, then that just becomes how you. It's just like any other work where you learn how to do it when you get the time and when you have to do it.
So the deadlines are good at even unblocking any sort of writer's block that you might experience.
I think if you're not clear in your mind about what is it that you're writing, or what is it that you want to write about, no amount of deadlines or nothing is going to unblock it. So a lot of the process of writing is really about understanding what you need to write about. And that, depending on what is it that you're attempting to write, whether it's a news story or a feature or, you know, a book, a lot of that is rumination, and that process is very hard to codify.
Mm-hmm.
But just having a deadline is not going to unblock any writer's block. The writer's block usually is because you haven't understood the material well. I'm talking of nonfiction here. Fiction is a different beast, and I wouldn't want to comment on that.
No, I think that's actually a very clear understanding of what a writer's block is. I'm also curious about, so I've often thought that a person is revealed as much by their musical self as their writing or speaking self. So I was wondering if you could tell us about whether there are any songs you listen to, music you listen to when you need inspiration.
I listen to a lot of music, but I don't think of it as listening to it for inspiration. I like a very wide variety of music. So, but it's more for listening pleasure, not to inspire my writing. In my mind, they're not connected in the same way. I mean, it might happen unconsciously that's how it's working on me, but that's not why I'm thinking of music. Like when I listen to music, it's because I just love the music.
I just wanted to remind our listeners, we're nearing the top of the hour, so if you have a question or a comment or a reflection you'd like to share, please press *6 on your phone or send a message to ask@servicespace.org or submit something through your web link, and we will turn to it. So thanks. Go ahead, Gayatri.
Yeah. Anil, I was also wondering whether, like, of all the patients you interacted with for your second book, to what extent is, you know, their musical self in some ways disrupted in the different conditions, because there are so many ways that we are anchored in our sense of identity, and I think
music would certainly be, I mean, and Oliver Sacks has written a lot about that. I personally didn't inquire as to, you know, what music may or may not do to how they were feeling. But I know for one example where the importance of music, or the act of making music rather than listening to music, was really important to one person who was suffering from depersonalization disorder. Depersonalization is a disorder, be careful here, is a condition where the person suffering feels detached from their own body and their own emotional state. So it's almost like there is an I that is not connected anymore with the bodily state or the body itself. And it's a source of tremendous anxiety and fear when that happens. And this guy that I was talking to, he would say that when he played the drums, because it required such an intense focus on all his four limbs, his two hands and his two legs, that he has this condition, it's chronic for him, so he's constantly in a state of depersonalization. At least he was for a length of time when I was talking to him. And he said that the act of engaging with his whole body when he was playing the drums was actually a relief, that those would be moments when he would literally come back into his body. And so that was probably the only thing I can think of where music had a connection with how someone felt about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, we have a few callers and in queue, and also some comments in from the web. But what I'd like to take host prerogative for a second, if I could, and ask you, Anil. Your book is entitled "The Man Who Wasn't There or Isn't There." And I'm curious what that refers to in your mind.
So the One answer is that even the publishers were thinking about a title that was actually playing off of Oliver Sacks' The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Match. So the phrase "the man who" has become a trope in nonfiction. So this was playing off of that. But then within that, once you accept that the marketing people had their own desire for that title, leaving that aside, the man who wasn't there refers to a few things. One is it's alluding to the idea that the self is not as permanent as we think it is. It's also referring to potentially what happens to someone with Alzheimer's, that there is a kind of part of oneself that is actually disappearing. It also refers to Cotard syndrome, where someone with Cotard's will say that they don't exist. They actually are completely convinced that they have died, even though they're fully functioning in a certain way, because they can also be very depressed at that moment in time. But the key one of the key aspects of how they feel about themselves is that they don't exist. So the title kind of is referring to a few of those ideas within the book.
I see. And as a scientist, I'm wondering, did you approach the book and the various people that you met and the stories that you uncovered, did you begin it with a hypothesis of some sort? And if so, how was that hypothesis confirmed, altered, or negated by your research and work?
Rita, firstly, I should point out I'm not a scientist, but an engineer. Scientists would take objections to me calling myself a scientist. So I'm an engineer. So that apart. Did I start with a hypothesis? No, I didn't start with a hypothesis. All I started was with this idea that these are disruptions of the self. When someone with Cotard is saying, "I don't exist," it's a very clear disruption of the sense of existence that we otherwise always feel. Like most of us at any time will not debate the question about whether we exist or not. We say, of course we exist. So the fact that somebody is suffering from Cotard and the perception they have within themselves is that of non-existence, that already is telling you that, okay, this can tell us something about the larger question of what it means to say I exist. So each of these conditions that I was exploring, I was trying to understand the disruptions. So what was happening? What happens when someone with schizophrenia hears voices that are not their own in their heads, or has thoughts that feel like they're not their own? What does that tell us about situations that we otherwise feel, where our thoughts implicitly feel like our own? So what is happening? So for a long time, I actually could not synthesize that. I ended up writing 7 chapters on each of these conditions, and I still couldn't figure out what was the common thread. And it took the last 3 months of the writing of the book, it came down to that, where I ended up having 3 intense conversations with 3 philosophers, and then finally it clicked into place. So yeah, so to answer your question, I didn't begin with the hypothesis, except the hypothesis that maybe the disruptions of the self could tell us something about the construction of the self.
Yeah, so I'm just curious about that last thing you mentioned, where you said you couldn't quite compute when someone was saying, "I don't exist," or "I don't have a self," and then you talked to philosophers, and then you were able to somehow come to terms with that. I'm just curious, can you describe what the philosophers talked about and what you were struggling with that they helped resolve?
Yeah, so I think what I eventually, so the book needed kind of a meta structure within which I could then analyze these conditions and understand what each of them were telling us about the nature of the self. And what eventually resolved was this idea that we can think of the self, you can slice and dice the self in many different ways. So you can talk about the narrative self, the bodily self, the social self, the spiritual self, all sorts of things. But there is one distinction you can start with, which is very basic, which is the self as subject and the self as object, which means that, so if I say I am happy or I am sad, then sadness is is a property of your sense of self, and the thing that is feeling the sadness is the I, the subject of the experience of sadness. So once you start thinking of there is a self as subject, which is the subject of all experiences, and then you look at everything else as an experience, whether it is an experience of being a body, whether it's the experience of being a story, a narrative, whether it's the experience of having a hand that feels like your own or having a hand that doesn't feel like your own. So there's always a self as subject. And there are all these other attributes of the sense of self that just get lumped into the self as object category. So once I could figure out that there is this distinction you could make, then you can also make the argument that everything that gets lumped into the self as object category is actually a construction that is being experienced by the self as subject. The question just becomes, what is that self as subject? What is that I that experiences a thought as one's own or a thought as not your own? And that, you know, once that categorization became clear and I could analyze everything with that lens, then the book structure fell into place.
I see. And then if I understood what you were saying earlier to Gayatri, you were saying you didn't ultimately try to resolve that question of who is the I behind, or who is the subject? Is there a subject apart from the, okay.
No, so the intent of the book was to be completely grounded in empirical evidence. So the only thing that the evidence can support is that all of the self as object categories can be shown through the lens of these various conditions, that they are things that are constructed by the brain and body and they can fall apart. But even if they fall apart, the I doesn't go away.
Interesting.
And it's there's no empirical evidence at this point to say what that I is or if that is itself an appearance, an illusion.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. I just have one last little question before we get to our cue. You mentioned that you don't have a lot of vivid childhood memories, or at least details. And I'm just curious, has your own sense of self evolved? Would you say that you've had disruptions in your sense of self over the course of your life or just had natural impermanence?
It's breaking up. I'll try and reconnect if that's okay.
Okay, sure.
Sure.
So we'll just wait for him to reconnect. Gayathri, I wonder, what course did you take with Anil, and what was your experience with him as a teacher?
So Anil actually, since 2011, has been teaching a course in science journalism in NCBS, where I did my PhD, and it's basically to try and start, training like maybe a whole generation of science journalists. So this was a short course in science journalism. It just ran for a week. Now I think it runs a little longer. And it's to try and... Okay, 2 weeks. Anil's back.
Great.
And Gayathri, even your time it was 2 weeks. You just think it was 1 week, but...
Really? I sort of distinctly remember maybe 10 days.
No, it was 10 working, no, it was actually in your time, it was longer. It was 2.5 weeks. And it's come down now to 2 weeks, yes.
He's just messing with my...
Maybe it was so good that time really flew, so...
Yeah.
You know me, I was multitasking. I was also working on a paper, so...
Right.
So, Anil, the question I had of you was that you mentioned that you don't have vivid childhood memories, and you don't, I'm curious, you don't seem to be someone, in the way you're talking about your childhood, as someone who's created a tightly constructed notion of self, or I'm just wondering, do you have a sense of self that has been disrupted over time, or do you think there's been a natural impermanence, or have you spent time thinking about your narrative self?
I mean, I have spent a lot of time thinking about it. I can't tell you why I'm interested in this subject, but I've been interested in it since my, early 20s. I've read books about it or heard people talk about it. There's always been an interest, and I think it's that interest that has kind of driven me towards writing about it, because I just felt that, A, I'm fascinated by the subject, and also, like we were talking about earlier, you know, when you're writing about something, you just have to deepen your understanding so much more, and that was always a pleasure. Have I had a sense of impermanence? No, actually quite the contrary. I think I feel the anxieties that come with a permanent self quite acutely sometimes. And it's because of that I'm driven to wanting to understand why, what is the source of that. So, I'm unfortunately don't feel impermanent at all. It's quite the opposite. And it also makes me aware that that's probably the source of a lot of anxiety.
Great. Right, I'm going to turn to one of our callers now.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Is this my turn?
Yes, it is.
Okay, my name is Mo. Thanks for your talk. I enjoyed it a lot. I would prepare a little bit context, and then I ask you the question. The context is that I believe personally that there is one oneness. Then if somebody comes and say, okay, the oneness you are talking about, there is another heaven and hell, or there is another world outside, I say, I would have no objection to that. I say, okay, let's include that one too. Then another person comes and says, oh, the universe, the oneness you are talking about, there is something beyond that one. This is this one. This is the description. I say, you are right. Let's include that one too. Then what is happening is that if I have no objection to any other claim, all of them will be included. Then that oneness has to be within itself. There is nothing outside. Because if anybody claims there is something outside of it, then I would say, let's include. Then my question is that how do you think about this oneness, and how can there be a oneness that it is within itself and there is nothing outside that?
Oh, it's a tough one. And the thing is that my way of thinking about all of these questions is really grounded in wanting to know about empirical evidence. And so oneness in the context of the people I talked to or the conditions I looked at, the only place where that came about was in something called ecstatic epilepsy. Where people would, when they were having a seizure, would talk about this feeling of being connected to something larger or being part of something larger. And the explanation, I mean, this may be a trivial explanation, but, you know, when they're having a seizure, when they talk about what it feels like, it's very, very similar to a mystical experience, and mystics will also talk about this feeling of oneness. Now, this is not to say, I have to be very careful, this is not to say that a mystic is having a seizure. That's not the point I'm making. The point is that within the context of ecstatic seizures, there is a way in which one can understand the feeling of oneness, and that has to do with the potential cessation of the narrative self. Like, normally, we are very, very aware of our boundaries, whether it is the boundaries of our bodily self or our psychological self. The stories in our heads are actually delineating us from whatever else is non-self. So the cessation of any part of that process is a cessation of certain boundaries. That is actually being biologically constructed by your brain and body. So that's the only context in which I can talk about what oneness might be. There is really no other way for me to empirically talk about what that might be, because it really is in the realm of speculation and ideas that I personally don't have enough knowledge to share. But if you look at what ecstatic seizures do, they really do provide a window into what it must be like to be an organism that just lives, like you hear this phrase, living in the here and now. What does that mean? To be vividly aware of one's body and one's environment, and yet feel like you're connected to something larger. And that connection really might be just the cessation of certain kinds of narrative, that certain kinds of activities associated with the narrative self, where you're constantly moving back and forth in your mind in time. We all do that all the time. And if that ceases, maybe there is a certain way in what one feels. I hope that helps.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. So we have a question that came in from one of our listeners on the webcast, and they ask about the disease of narcissism. And the question is, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how the condition of narcissism, I'm calling it condition, the disease of narcissism, affects an individual's sense of self.
I mean, sir, I didn't study narcissism as a condition for my book, so I'll have to talk more generally than I would be able to otherwise. But, you know, I think all of us are on a spectrum of not being a narcissist and being a narcissist. So I think each one of us can relate to situations where you cannot not think about yourself, or you're able to completely think about others before you think of yourself. And if we all are capable of that in terms of how we function in life, then what it means is that our brains and bodies have that capacity, and sometimes we unfortunately can get stuck in the wrong end of it, where you are only obsessing about yourself. If you start thinking of these as neural processes that are working in us constantly, all physical processes fall on a distribution of, you know, properties, and so sometimes you can get, you know, that physical system gets stuck in one end of the distribution, and you end up with a situation where you're constantly obsessing about only yourself. So that's a very sort of mechanistic explanation of how I think about it. This doesn't take into account, of course, you know, why someone is like that, and what's the responsibility, the morality of it. All those are very difficult questions.
Mm-hmm. We also have a question from Ruchi, who asks actually about the meditation practice of Vipassana, and she wants to understand it from the perspective of neuroscience. She says, I've been a bit of a neuroscience buff, reading much of V.S. Ramachandran and Oliver Sacks, and came across your book last year, which I very much enjoyed. She asks if you're familiar with the technique of Vipassana, which involves passing your attention through the body while remaining still. And she says, has there been any neuroscientific study on this process? I'm curious about the perspective. How does passing consciousness or attention through parts of your body make those sensations more pronounced? And how does our non-reaction allow these sensations to pass, akin to the letting go of past anguishes and hurts that manifest in negative emotional patterns within us? So she's basically saying I'd like to ask you about the neuroscience of enlightenment.
I wouldn't want to comment on the neuroscience of enlightenment, given that we don't understand what enlightenment might mean. But because we're finally, you know, we're beginning to talk about very subjective ideas, that, you know, so it's very hard to say what enlightenment is from the outside. But I know about Vipassana. I have done the 10-day Vipassana course, and so I've sat through that, and knowing too much about neuroscience was actually oddly, strangely detrimental, because there were times when I was sitting and thinking, I am not really aware of my body, I'm just aware of the maps of my body in my brain, and so that kind of stuff was constantly going around in my head. But saying that, keeping that apart, I think the way I kind of understand, this is just one person's perspective. I don't even know how to substantiate this from a scientific perspective. But this, you know, I just feel like what meditation allowed me to do was, when you make a pact with yourself that you're just going to sit and watch yourself, you know, whatever thoughts are arising, whatever emotional states your body is in, and you're not reacting. So again, my kind of empirical mind or mechanistic mind wants to make sense of it by saying, well, normally if something had happened when I was not sitting but just functioning in the real world, I would react. I would just do whatever the emotional state of my body told me to, because that's what fundamentally emotions are. They are the things that drive our bodies to do what the body needs to do. And and they can be good or bad, but without any value judgment, they are just things that cause our bodies to act. But when you're sitting down and just observing, you are actually strengthening those parts of your brain and body that are allowing you to watch an emotion without actually being reactionary. So somewhere you're literally like placing, you're slipping a piece of paper between the emotion, emotional state of your body and some part of you that is observing it. Normally you wouldn't have that capacity. So you're developing that capacity, and just that in itself to me is a profound thing that meditation would allow me to do, is just develop, literally develop a little distance between the emotional state of the body and an action that follows it. And maybe in that little distance, you have the space to rethink your actions or not react. And by doing it, you know, over and over again, you're really strengthening a lot of neural circuits that allow you that space and allow you that place from where you can say, oh, this I shouldn't do or this I should do. That's one very mechanistic way of thinking about it. I think there are so many other things that happen in meditation that I'm not qualified to even speculate upon, because it is something quite unusual and profound that we do when we sit down and say, all I'm going to do is watch. And a lot of what meditation might be doing has to do with questions about what consciousness is, which we don't know, what attention is, which we don't quite know. These are all various processes. And until those things become clear, it's hard to say what exactly meditation is doing in neuroscientific terms.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, I'm struck because you said earlier that you said my meditation practice or a form of meditation for me is writing. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, and then you said that your writing is done on deadline, obviously, as a journalist that gets paid. I'm curious, does that meditative practice of writing in that form, does that provide you with a sense of peace or joy or anything like that? I'm just curious.
Writing does for me. So even if it is being done on deadline, the deadline is, yeah, something I have to honor, and because a lot of people are depending, you know, on when an editor has given you a deadline, there's a whole machinery behind that that is waiting for copy. So you have to honor that. But the act of writing itself, yeah, I think even if it's a 400-word piece or a 4-page piece or a 300-page book, I think the act of writing is joyful. Watching ideas take shape and coherently, yeah, I find that very lovely.
That's beautiful. I when I asked you earlier about your interest in the sense of self, you responded in a little bit of a objective way, an intellectual way, that you've always been interested in this subject. I guess I'm wondering, have you ever personally tried to construct a narrative of your own personal self? Has that been something you've consciously thought to do?
Not consciously, not in the sense of saying this is what I'm going to be 5 years from now and let me do that. No, I don't think I did that. But I didn't mean to come across as somebody very objective about this. The reason for thinking about the self, etc., have a lot to do with what I talked about earlier, that there is a feeling that permanence that one feels about oneself, and then consequently any disturbances to whatever that self might be, whatever, you know, might be happening in your life that knocks that self around, and the distress that it causes. So the inquiry comes from that, comes from the desire to understand the distress or understand the anxiety. And so it is, you know, even though the inquiry is intellectual, I think its basis is still what is being felt in one's life, in one's body and mind. And so to me, it seems a continuum that I wouldn't want to put it as an intellectual exercise alone. It's also about feeling a certain way, feeling, you know, wanting to be at peace. And by peace, I literally mean not feeling disturbed in the body and mind.
We have a question from Belmont, California. Puppy says, gratitude for an insightful conversation. I wanted to ask Anil, what questions are most alive for you today, and what are you navigating with your next book or piece of writing?
The next book is on quantum mechanics. It's looking at, there's this lovely experiment in quantum mechanics called the double slit experiment, which has been with us for 100 years in various forms. So the book is really exploring the development of quantum mechanics through the lens of this one experiment. But really the joy of doing that is, again, trying to get at the heart of our understanding of the material world. And somewhere there's a deeper interest in wanting to start thinking about consciousness and materialism now, and trying to understand matter and the mind in some way. So that there's a long term desire to want to do that now.
Mm-hmm. So interestingly, I'm curious what you, now having written and thought about the subjects that you've written and thought about, I wonder if you think, what is the role of science in answering the question of the self? What do you personally think is the role of science in that? Do you think science can help us solve that, or is that something that each person subjectively figures out for themselves?
I mean, experientially, each person has to figure it out for oneself, right? I mean, I don't think knowledge by itself changes one's fundamental experience of being a self. So, you are what you are in terms of, you're a combination of the genetic inheritance that your body is, the social structures that you're part of, and all the social interactions that you're having, the country that you were born in, all sorts of things go into making who you are. And no amount of talking about impermanence is going to change that fact that you are that thing. But to me, science has a role to play in terms of just, a certain amount of intellectual understanding of the matter at hand is, an example is, the various philosophies about the nature of the self. If they can't be, if empirical evidence contradicts that, then you have to let those ideas go, no matter how wonderful those ideas might be. For instance, this idea that all we are, there are philosophers who have argued over time that all we are is a narrative self. The sense of an I comes about because there are stories in our head swirling about that give us a sense of being an I, as being the author of those stories. And Alzheimer's kind of starts showing you that, you can be an I even after the stories have been knocked out because of, memory loss. So, so that is very, very clear intellectual understanding of something that needs to feed into, how we process it within ourselves. And I feel it's a false dichotomy to be thinking about these things as separate. They're all modes of inquiry, and they all have to eventually start converging. And if they're not converging, it's because we are touching, different parts of an elephant and have no idea of the whole. But at some stage, what we are right now doing is talking about things experientially from within, and science might be too far away from being able to make sense of individual subjective experiences. But eventually they have to converge. At least that's the way I feel. And so... the act of convergence is, hopefully arriving at some ground truth about what this existence is about. And we may be very far from that.
We have time for one last live question, so I will go with that. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you so much. This is Elisa in Seattle. And my question is more of a comment, or just... I missed some of the call, so I hope it wasn't involved in that. But are you familiar with the book My Stroke of Insight?
Yeah, by Jill Bolt Taylor, right?
Sorry?
By Jill Bolt Taylor? right?
Yes. And so that when she talked about her stroke and kind of the place of going back and forth between her brain and, I don't know, it explains some of what you're explaining to me in a bit. I don't know if it's the same thing, but that physiological place can affect the perceptive place. It was fascinating to me.
I haven't read her book, but I have read, I've watched her talks and maybe read articles about what she's said, so I wouldn't say I'm totally familiar with her argument, but I remember being extremely moved by what she was talking about.
I see. If you read the book, she describes how she goes back and forth as she's having the stroke, and then she went back later, and I think she even did some meditation and counseling or whatever to try to get to those places, to get to the place of remembering, but what it was like, and describes it, her experience, as what is happening to her physiologically, which helped with when you were talking about the seizures, helping me understand that. And the other place, yes, and so it might be interesting just with your questions. The other was that when you couldn't make the book fall into place, you said you went and talked to other philosophers. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
And I just wondered, in somehow expanding and getting more information and different perceptions from different areas allowed you to put things into place instead of just going along the same line. It sounded that helped you bring things together.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what happened there. Alicia from Seattle was asking something and I lost the connection.
Yes. What I was asking was, it sounded like you had to go maybe to other areas to get out of one line of looking at things, to get more information and to allow yourself then to come back and have things fall into place.
I think that was the case. And what had happened was that after I had written sort of 7 out of the 8 chapters of the book, the fact that it wasn't falling into place, what also happened was that my questions for the philosophers became very pointed. I really now knew that I needed to understand some very specific things. So rather than doing an interview which was quite general, saying, oh, tell me what you think about this or that, I was very particular about what I needed to understand. And I could sort of, because of having written so much and still struggling to make sense of it, I could actually push them with very specific questions. And that kind of opened up, exactly like you said, just other avenues of inquiry and then being able to see the broader picture.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you. Thanks so much. Just before we like to end the call, we always like to ask our guest, and Anil in this case, is there anything we can do to support you, or what can we do as an ecosystem, as a global community, to support your work?
You're already supporting me. This is an absolute pleasure to be speaking with people who are interested in this topic and thinking about all these things. I have met a lot of you in the Bay Area, and it's just a pleasure to be part of this. So I would express my gratitude, saying you've already helped me a lot. So thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, with that, let's do a closing minute of silence, and then we will close with some gratitude. So with that, on 3, 1, 2, 3. Thank you, Anil.
Thank you,
Anil.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.